On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Technologies achieved a degree of sophistication beyond our wildest dreams, but this technology has exacted a pretty heavy price. We live in an age of anxiety, a time of stress, and with all our sophistication, we are in fact the victims of our own technological strength. We are the victims of shock, of future shock.
Orson Welles there in a 1972 documentary about the idea of future shock, a phrase coined by futurist Alvin Toffler. Toffler died this week. He was 87 years old. Coming up, we remember him and we talk about the futurists of today. But first, the future of affordable housing in Los Angeles. The city council has approved a request by the owner of a Hollywood apartment building to turn it into a boutique hotel. Tenants' rights advocates have been fighting the plan. They say city officials talk a good talk when it comes to affordable housing, but then they turn around and approve projects like that one and get rid of affordable housing. To find out what the city is really doing about reining in housing costs, we're joined now by Emily Alpert-Reyes, City Hall reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, I understand there was a lively debate in the city council over whether the owner of this building in Hollywood should be allowed to turn it into a hotel. And what reason did the council members give for approving it, for moving forward?
Well, in a committee earlier this week, the argument that both the attorneys for the building owner, planning officials, and most council members ended up making was that there wasn't a legal basis to block this from happening, that the arguments that the tenant advocates were making about the social and economic effects on the neighborhood were not ones that they could consider under the California Environmental Quality Act.
And they said that, look, as much as we don't like this, we have to abide by state law. And state law in this instance is the Ellis Act. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, the Ellis Act is actually the law that allowed them to initially evict people from this building. So this is a rent-controlled building in Hollywood. Generally, there's protections for tenants in those kinds of buildings to try to prevent landlords from kicking them out so they can charge higher rent. But under the Ellis Act, landlords can do that if they plan to take the housing off the rental market or to demolish the building to put up new apartments, and that's part of what happened in this case.
So the landlord says, I want to turn this into a hotel. You all need to get out. It's that simple?
There's more process to it than that, but yeah, it makes the eviction process significantly easier.
And what do the tenants get? Do they get anything?
Well, so the city has rules about relocation aid, which can be, I think up to, if I remember right, it's probably updated, but up to around $19,000, depending on, whether somebody's disabled or kind of what their circumstances are. But, a certain amount of assistance that you get to basically help you find a new place and deal with higher rents, because that's often what you have to do if you're moving out of somewhere you've been for a while. In this case, part of what made this controversial was that the owner had used an exemption that's under LA City law for if you've put in an application with the city to turn a building into condos, the renters who move in after you have that application in can be made to sign waivers that say, hey, you don't get relocation aid because you know that we're turning this place into condos. Part of what happened here was that they had a plan to turn it into condos. It fell apart. And so they ended up eventually doing this plan about the hotel instead. And the complaint from some of the tenant advocates was, you had people in this building who didn't, about half of the tenants didn't get relocation assistance because of that exemption, even though it didn't ultimately become condos. And so they were arguing, is there any way to get more assistance for these folks in retrospect?
And is there? I mean, why? How can they do that? How can the landlord do that? Say it's going to be condos. Well, now it's not, so we don't have to pay you.
Well, so apparently it's what's in effect at the time that the tenant signs the waiver. Mm-hmm. So the housing department, came to this hearing and said, this guy did everything right. They didn't break any rules here. And so some of the council members are now saying, well, maybe we need to look at these rules.
And get rid of this exemption?
Maybe not get rid of it. Some people are talking about that, but I think there's also discussion about do we put something in place that you have to make the conversion within a certain period of time, or that if you don't ultimately do it, that there's some kind of redress for the tenants. When the vote about this particular hotel conversion went to council tomorrow, there was some discussion from Councilman Gil Cedillo, who actually wasn't there for the vote, which was taken very quickly at the beginning of the meeting, later said, I wish we could have attached something to this where one of the conditions of the approval was that they would make these payments, but that didn't ultimately happen.
Well, what does this tell you about the bigger picture of affordable housing in Los Angeles?
Well, I think one of the big concerns that tenant advocates have had is that, there's sort of two things you can do to improve the stock of affordable housing, right, or to at least maintain it. One is to be building new housing, which is something that LA is talking about with this potential bond that voters might be asked to approve to help build lots of housing, which would support folks that would otherwise be homeless. The other is to maintain the housing that we have. And I think a lot of the criticism has been that the city's sort of bleeding that kind of housing. This is not a huge apartment complex. It's 18 units. But the argument that the tenants' rights groups make is, you sort of have this death by a thousand cuts thing where one by one these buildings get converted and you lose a lot of, housing that was more affordable for working folks. I mean, the apartments in this building were going for some of them for like $650 a month or less, which if you've tried to look for an apartment in the Hollywood area in the past couple of years, I mean, it's just not possible to find that kind of thing anymore. And that's why some of the former tenants in this building had really struggled. There was one guy, a former Vietnam vet, who says he's homeless now. He sofa surfs, he goes to the food bank. He cannot find anything remotely near that, so that he can have the kind of life he used to have.
Yeah. Well, isn't there some kind of requirement that when new apartments are built, developers, in this case it's a hotel, but in other cases, that the developer needs to set aside some for low-income residents?
I don't know as much about the specifics on that. I mean, I do know that they would have to be subject to rent control, mm-hmm. but the way rent control works in LA, once the apartment's vacant, the landlord can increase it to whatever the market rate is, and then the restrictions are on how much you can then raise the rent annually from there. But that still means that there's some leeway as soon as somebody moves out for a landlord to change what they're charging.
Emily Alpert-Reyes is City Hall reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you been evicted by a landlord using the Ellis Act? Are you concerned your landlord might be angling to convert your rent-controlled apartment building? Or are you just having trouble finding an affordable place to live in Los Angeles? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Alvin Toffler has died, the author of Future Shock. Is futurism also dead? And Shani Jardin is here with Web News. It's next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Facebook has changed its newsfeed algorithm to focus on stuff posted by your friends and family. The news business is not happy. We're going to talk about that and more news of the web with our friend Shani Jardin. More than a Facebook friend to us.
Not one bit happy today about these algorithmic changes.
So what happened? Are they pulling the rug out from these news organizations? Because originally they said, hey, come on in.
Yeah.
We'll be home to all your news stuff and we'll refer people to your sites.
Yeah.
And now?
Boy, I'm so confused, and I am one of many people who work in news who are confused. So, you know, all of us who use Facebook, we've come to find familiar a mix of, you know, cat pics, wedding photos, snapshots and selfies, births, deaths, funerals, all that kind of family social mm-hmm. stuff that's mixed in with, like, the Nigella Lawson guest DJ project on KCRW, or the latest thing that your uncle is convinced about that is a wacky conspiracy theory involving Obama and Trump and aliens. So now what Facebook is saying is that after really a couple of years of very intensely courting news partners, BuzzFeed, The New York Times, all kinds of different big publishers to basically put their content on Facebook first and treat Facebook like a primary publishing platform. After talking many of those organizations out of sweet, sweet dollars and sweet, sweet clicks, they announced this. The bad news always comes in the kind of sneakiest way from Facebook. It was just announced as it was like an update in network priorities. Like, we're really going to try to be better to our users by making sure that the important friends and family updates come first. And basically, when you strip away sort of all the wiggle words around it, it sounds like Facebook is going to be deprioritizing news content. So if I've signed up for, I love Press Play, I want to see everything that Press Play posts on Facebook, unless Press Play pays money to expose every single post to me, even though I've signed up for every single post, I'm not going to see them. We don't know exactly how this is going to affect publishers, small ones like Boing Boing, the independent blog that I'm a part of, or really large ones, the New York Times, CNN, whatever. We don't exactly know, but judging from how freaked out my journalist and social media professional friends are, it's not going to be good for news. And it seems so kind of duplicitous after Facebook positioned itself. And it is. It's the source that more Americans go to for news.
Well, let me ask you how it actually will work. So let's say I go onto my Facebook feed and I regularly click on something from Boing Boing.
That's
I'm not
right.
actively signed up, but I click on your stuff. Doesn't that then tell Facebook that that's what I want to see, and then they would put that in my feed?
Yeah, it's like they're tweaking the frequency through which you see things that friends and family have forwarded and shared from other news sites versus things that you have signed up directly to see. So, for instance, I love the New York Times. I follow them on Facebook. I pay for a subscription. I may see less New York Times items directly in my feed, but my friend Michael Rosten, who writes for the New York Times, if he posts something in his feed about something that he's very passionate about and three or four of my other New York Timesy friends share it, then perhaps I'll be more likely to see it. Honestly, it's not very clear to me.
Well, what's in it for Facebook?
I don't understand it, but the explanation that they gave, the thing that went out in the press release is, you know, we've heard from our users, and our users don't want to miss important updates from family, from friends, from loved ones, from individuals that they have a social connection with. And basically, you know, I'm not quoting them, but they basically said, this isn't a news site. We never intended this to be the future of news. It's just a social network.
Right. Well, meanwhile, they were accused of being partisan during this election.
Yeah. There was this whole thing where Gawker published an item, an anonymously sourced item, which said that people who worked at Facebook who were in charge of that trending news story section were giving preferential treatment to non-conservative news items and sort of squelching the right-wing sites.
Would this have anything to do with this?
It's not really clear.
It's opaque, all of it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, when I was chatting with my colleagues yesterday morning, whenever they announce something like this, the reaction cycle for me is usually number one, we're all going to die. And number two, wait,
what?
Everything's like, what? And then three, carry on. Keep calm and carry on.
Okay, let's carry on to another piece of Facebook news. And that is, it told a reporter that they use your phone location to recommend new friends. And then they said, oh, wait, no, we don't.
Man, talk about
speaking of opaque, what's happening there?
Facebook, the flip-flopper. Yeah, Kashmir Hill, a reporter at Fusion, which is kind of a millennials-oriented news site, she just kept hearing all these anecdotes from people that they were getting friend suggestions that seemed to be based on location data. She gave an anecdote of a dad who was in a support group for parents who are dealing with suicidal issues in their kids. And he got a friend suggestion from somebody who the only thing they had in common is that they'd like been at this anonymous fellowship at the same time. So she looked into some other stories, found more anecdotes. She reached out to Facebook, and a Facebook rep did something shocking. They told the truth. they said that you know, yes, we have used location data to recommend friends. You know how when you log into Facebook and there's these suggestions of people that you may or may not know, would you like to add them to your network? So anyway, Kashmir Hill contacted Facebook. She got that answer. And then the next day, after the internet flipped out over it, what? This is a privacy violation. Facebook should not be using my smartphone's location to suggest friends who are just near me. You could, you know, there's all kinds of privacy violation and security problems that could happen. So Facebook the next day said, oh, we didn't really mean that. We're actually not doing that. And then the following day, today, we now know, we think we know, that Facebook ran a test involving some portions of its users. Some portion, we don't know what portion.
Maybe all.
Maybe all, maybe just a handful, sometime last year. So for an indeterminate population, indeterminate length of time, they did some kind of testing on that user base. Not the first time they've done this. They also did this with emotional response a few years back. They were widely criticized for it. So this time, they ran a test, which it seems is over. They tell us they're no longer using location-based data. So not your smartphone's GPS coordinates, not the IP address of your Wi-Fi network, not information about the fact that you and I, Madeline, are on a shared Wi-Fi network here at KCRW now. They're not using any of that right now, but they did in the past for a period of time with a certain number of users. It's all in a black box, and you and I do not own the keys to that black box. It's really creepy. And if you're freaked out about this, you should not have Facebook on your phone.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of boingboing.net. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And what do you think about this new policy by Facebook to prioritize friends and family in your feed over news organizations? Let us know, of course, on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Futurist Alvin Toffler has died. He was 87 years old. Toffler authored a trilogy of best-selling books beginning in 1970 with Future Shock. That sold 15 million copies. It's still in print today. In that book, Toffler made incredibly accurate predictions about how science and technology would shape humankind. He forecasted cloning, for example, the invention of the internet and cable TV, and the massive popularity of the personal computer. And futurists are still trying to do that today to predict how innovation will shape the future. That's what Daniel Burris does. He's a global futurist and the author of Flash Foresight: How to See the Invisible and Do the Impossible. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Okay. Well, you knew Alvin Toffler. You sat in on a few of his keynote addresses. Did he inspire you to do what you do?
Yes, not originally. I started back in the early 80s, and I had already had started five companies. And before that, I was actually taught biology and physics. So I was in the education teaching mode and in the science mode. But I knew of his work because it went back to the 70s. And basically, I first met him in the mid-80s. Not only did I hear him speak, but I was extremely excited that back at that time, he and his wife, Heidi, were in the front row hearing me speak. Mm. And it was one of the great joys, as you might guess, being a futurist, to have Toffler in the front row with his wife. And he gave me a lot of encouragement, really liked what I was talking about. I met him again in the 90s. And basically, he was truly an amazing guy. Just think about it a second. There was not a science of futurism as it existed before. People weren't thinking about the future. They were just going about their daily lives. And a few people would think a little bit about it, but they weren't really making it into a profession. I think Toffler really brought it to the media through his best-selling book, Future Shock, which was amazing, mm-hmm. and really brought an awareness to the business world that there's something beyond the next quarter, although, as you and I both know, they tend to forget that as well.
So, let me just stop you there, because he once said, no serious futurist deals in predictions. And what did he mean by that, even though he was, in fact, dealing with predictions?
Yeah, well, he was really, and as you said, heck, he did it himself, and he was a serious futurist, and I've made hundreds of predictions in my six books and so on, and I think the key is you want to be looking at the context for those predictions and taking really where are the big, giant, fundamental shifts going, and I think that that's what he was referring to is the giant shifts are more important than the small, minuscule day-to-day shifts.
And what did he predict in terms of giant shifts?
Well, as you said yourself, he was talking about, I think the really big thing is his big shift was the convergence of science, capital, and communications. That's a giant shift that was not converged back then. Mm. And talking about how those things, if you think about it, the world of science, the world of capital, which is Wall Street, and the world of communications, think of it as telecom, coming together to create swift and rapid change. Now, that swift and rapid change, since he wrote that in the 70s, wasn't exactly that swift and rapid, but he got those three elements in that convergence quite right. So if you don't get hung up on how rapid it was and rather look at what he saw, then you've got something pretty significant. I think that's what he was getting at.
And his views were about this rapid change were pretty grim. He argued that we wouldn't be able to keep up with this change. We'd be isolated. Our families would fall apart. We'd do more drugs, commit more crime.
But having heard him speak twice myself, as well as reading his books, He was optimistic, not pessimistic. Mm. And by the way, since I've been doing this now for 34 years, I continue to be optimistic because I think for the same reason, and that is humans can do amazing, impossible things when we set our minds beyond personal ego and could do something that is beyond just the self. And we can, almost every problem we've ever solved at one time was impossible. Hey, they're doing this interview is impossible one time in human history. So we have been able to do impossible things over and over again. How can you not be optimistic when you know that we can overcome those things because we have that capability?
Well, isn't that the basis for your job, though? You're supposed to be finding solutions, so therefore you need to be optimistic because you believe there are solutions to be found?
Yes, and I think that what fueled him during those decades and those books, as well as has fueled me in the decades that I've been doing it, is the fact that you can actually see impossible problems indeed being solved by the things that you write about and the things that you speak about. I know I've experienced that, I'm proud to say, and I know he did that as well. So I think that's what keeps us going, is we're not just talking about the future, but giving strategies and ways of actually, again, solving those impossible problems and, more importantly, seeing those problems before they happen so that we have the window to pre-solve them. I call that being the anticipatory competency, because rather than being reactionary, I'd like us to be anticipatory. And I think Toffler didn't use that word in those phrases, but I think that's what really he was trying to do as well.
Well, what are you anticipating as a futurist?
Well, we are going to, let me give you a short-range prediction. Most futurists never do that because you might remember it. But I will, because I want you all to remember it. And I call these based on hard trends, meaning they're future facts. They're going to happen even if you don't like it. And that is, over the next 5 short years, we will not change. We will transform every business process, how we sell, how we market, how we communicate, how we collaborate, how we innovate, how we train, how we educate, how we sell things. How we buy things, how we do cybersecurity, that's all being not just changed, transformed. And now that's the hard trend, that's going to happen. Now, here's what I call the soft trend. Will your organization transform those processes?
What do you mean by transform?
Well, good question. That's why you are so good at this. the question, when I was a young guy, I could listen to an album, one album per spinning disc, 33 and a third. As I got older, I could get one album per smaller spinning disc called a CD. That created a change, not a transformation. I still had one disc. It was just a smaller spin. Today, I've got all my music in my smartphone along with all my videos and everything else. That didn't change how I listened to music. It transformed it. That's what I'm talking about. Something totally different than in the past. You see, that change, they were similar. They looked like each other. It was just more of an incremental versus a giant leap.
Right. But you're saying there's going to be a giant leap in 5 years, but you don't know what that leap will be. You just think there will be one?
I know specifically what that will be.
Well, tell us.
Yes. Well, if, for example, first of all, from a process standpoint, being able to transform every business process is giant, giant leaping. So there are many technologies that are in place that I would call exponential technologies, meaning not incremental, that are giving us the ability to accelerate innovation at tremendous speeds. So just take, for example, augmented reality, and that's just one of dozens that I write about and others write about. And augmented reality is the ability to take your phone's camera, hold it up, let's say if you're in New York City and you're thinking of buying a pair of shoes, and you say to your intelligent agent, I'm interested in a pair of Nike shoes, and hold it up, and it will actually show you where the stores are that have those shoes. Or if you're in a Walmart and you hold that phone up and you say, I want a customer service rep, it'll show you what aisle the real human is right now. And by the way, instead of using your phone, you're going to be using a new version of Google Glass. But instead of it looking weird, it's going to be integrated into your glasses that you have now, and it won't look weird. And you can use the side of your glasses to just fade in the information or fade it out to just see the world as you normally see it. That's coming like super fast, and by overlaying information, it's not just for people on the street buying things. Think about what that means to someone in a warehouse or some customers or someone repairing a car engine who can see all the data right there.
Yeah. So you and other futurists and Alvin Toffler as well, you saw technology as a good thing, not something to be afraid of.
Another great question, and that is, it's never the tool. It's always about how we use it. I know technologies that can give you cancer and technologies that can cure your cancer. It's not the tool that's good or evil. It's who's using that tool. It's how we decide to do it. So what do I want us to do? And that is not sit back and hope that tomorrow will be better than today, but rather to actively shape the future using the transformative tools that we have at our disposal.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Giving us a little window into what's coming. Daniel Burris, global futurist and author of Flash Foresight, How to See the Invisible and Do the Impossible. Coming up, a new documentary about three 13-year-olds who play heavy metal in a band. They get a $1.8 million record contract.
We've all gone through some type of experience as we were at that same age where we felt the world suddenly get much bigger, and that's what's happening to them in this film.
But did their world get too big too fast? That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. That YouTube video has been watched almost 2 million times. It's a band called Unlocking the Truth. They're playing in Times Square a couple of years ago. What you can't see is that Unlocking the Truth is a band made up of three black 13-year-olds from Brooklyn. A year after that video was made, Unlocking the Truth was signed to a $1.8 million recording contract. They played at South by Southwest, Coachella. They opened for Metallica and Guns N' Roses. A filmmaker named Luke Meyer followed them with his camera through it all. The result is a documentary called Breaking a Monster.
I know him since I was 4. We met at a birthday party. I asked him, do you want to start a band?
Malcolm gave me this white bass.
Then I just kept practicing. I got better and better.
The subtitle might have been, be careful what you wish for.
Overall, everything is not where it should be.
Your money isn't something called the
company. What are you talking about?
You'll wind up like Bieber, man.
Luke Meyer is here to talk about his movie. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, you began making a short film about this band, Unlocking the Truth, before they were signed. Did you know you had a feature length on your hands?
So we really made it as a standalone piece that was this portrait of pre-adolescent kids who were still at a point where they could dream about the world without really having to address how complex it is to achieve those dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a sort of pure moment of fantasy that you can have when you're a kid.
Yeah. And they were just playing on the streets in Times Square and just having a good time, not really thinking about getting a record deal.
I mean, they want everything that happens in the film. But at the time when we made the short, it was all like they had a board on the wall where a dream board where they would outline what they wanted to have happen. But it was really just something that existed in their mind at that point.
Tell us about these three kids, Alec Atkins, Malcolm Brickhouse, and Jared Dawkins, and how they got into heavy metal music.
Malcolm's dad took them to a wrestling show where the lead-in music for the wrestlers was heavy metal, and that made a huge impression on them. They also were into anime, and they would watch these videos where people would recut parts of these anime and play them like music videos over heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's really interesting to me about these kids, the age they are, is they came to this music through remediated ways. I mean, it wasn't like they came to it by listening to Metallica directly. They came to it because someone had programmed that music for a wrestler to enter the arena with. And they came to it because it was on a YouTube clip.
Then they get a manager, this guy who is a 70-year-old man named Alan Sachs. How did he find them and how did he get the job?
He found them, I think, in part by our short film.
I was on the plane the next day. I'm sort of rebellious. I'm a punk. You know, I'm against the system, or I was, but I am part of the system. And I want to work within the system, and I do work within the system, and these kids give me that opportunity.
Did he have a background in the music industry?
Well, he began in television and then moved into movies. His first big success was co-creating Welcome Back, Kotter. And then he moved into producing and writing a lot of teen-directed movies in the 80s, like Thrashing.
Mm-hmm.
Later, he moved on to work with Disney exclusively for a while, where he connected with the Jonas Brothers. And from there, that like led to a career in music.
So they go with him, and they fly out to Los Angeles to sign a contract, and they're at Sony. I just want to play a clip of tape from your movie where things get just a little weird.
What's important to you is it what's important to us. You have to dream a big dream like you did about how you manifested what stadiums you wanted to play in and what you wanted to happen with your careers, and we all believe that that's the way you achieve everything in life. You dream it, you write it, and you make it happen. So you did.
What are the kids doing and what are they thinking at that moment?
I mean, this is sort of what goes on in the movie all throughout, where you see all these scenes that are what they've been dreaming of, but it's not exactly how they thought it would go.
Yeah, and they are only kids, and they don't really understand it, nor should they have to understand this. Where are their parents in this? And what did their parents want?
Their parents wanted them to have these opportunities and to have this success if that's what they wanted. I mean, I feel like their parents were always there watching and making sure that their kids weren't put into any real compromising positions. They were very protective about school. They wanted to make sure that they weren't overworked, essentially, touring too much. And, I mean, you don't see that much of the other kids, Alec and Jared's parents, in the film. But it's because they weren't as actively day-to-day involved with the band as much as Malcolm's parents were, because they actually were managers of the band. But them not being present in the film doesn't mean that they weren't actually watching out for them.
Yeah. I want to play a clip from your movie where the members of the band are arguing over a concept for a music video proposed by their manager.
We can wait, and we can get something written, and it can take forever.
That's not what the song is about, and I would like the video to be matched with the song.
Okay, so you know what, guys? I'm going to forget that video. I'm not going to do it. You're going to have to wait a couple of months.
That's just going to happen.
Okay, that's fine.
I think the single is good, but the video needs to be held back for a while.
You're wrong.
What does that say to you, that scene right there?
I knew I wanted to tell the story of what the three guys went through. And so this scene ends up being very important to that, because it's a scene where they start asserting their own opinion about the creative decisions being made about how they're going to be seen in the world. And it's the first time you see that in the film.
And he wins, right?
Yeah, they don't make that video.
Yeah. There's another really powerful moment when Malcolm says that he knows that his band is a bit of a novelty act. He's responding to some criticism he hears on the radio, and here he is talking to his manager.
Because you're black, and they saw the uniqueness of it, that, and you can play an instrument, that's why they hired you. That's not the case. You think that's the case?
I don't know. I'm not stupid, Alan. That is the case.
I don't think that's the case at all. I know you're not stupid, but that's not the case.
Okay, whatever you say.
You think that's why you're hired now?
Yes.
No,
I don't care either.
The band always had to deal with the novelty question, right? They had to deal with it about being young. They had to deal with it about being black. They had to deal with it about playing against the stereotypes about the heavy metal genre. And in that moment, you understand how aware of it they are. And not only that, you understand that Malcolm has found a way to feel empowered by it. He knows that this is actually something he can use to get what he wants, to get this contract, to make these dreams happen. And it was a really important moment in filming, because the race question is in the film throughout. I mean, you see these three black kids, and almost all the people that they're meeting with are white adults.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Luke Meyer. He's the director of a new documentary called Breaking a Monster. It does seem, even though this is their dream and they have their dream board of where they want to play and what they want to do, and they did want to sign a record contract, that when it came to the reality of being a signed band, going on tour, sitting in these meetings, recording sessions, endless recording sessions. At one point, Malcolm's not allowed to ride the skateboard because he could fall and hurt his arm and then not be able to play the guitar. That all these things add up, and they don't seem to be having a good time at all in your movie. There's lots of scenes of them where they look pretty unhappy.
I would argue that you do see them really happy, and that's when they're playing music. Those moments you see, especially towards the end of the film, some of the later performances, you see real joy that they're able to kind of still find in doing that. I mean, it goes back to what I was saying, that this movie is a movie about dreams having to contend with a complex reality. It is a coming-of-age story, of course, right? So it is, these guys are all entering into adolescence. And I think we've all gone through some type of experience as we were at that same age where we felt the world suddenly get much bigger. And that's what's happening to them in this film. I mean, it's simultaneously happening to them as just people. Mm-hmm. But it's also happening to them because of their careers and what's happening and how that's expanding.
And what about the adults? What is their responsibility in this? The people at Sony, of course, they're out to make money. It's their job to make money. But do they have any special responsibility because these are children?
To step into a situation where you've got art and commerce mixing together, and there's someone with talent and someone and a an apparatus around it that is designed to both push it forward and make money off of it, you're going to end up with a pretty similar story. But like, we can feel what feels wrong when we watch children go through this, even though I bet a 25-year-old going through it, it's going to be almost the same thing.
Yeah. Do they get a lot of money out of all this? Did they actually get the $1.8 million?
No. You know, that's a flashy headline. Record deals are essentially, it's not money that they're just given. It's money that they're given and then they have to pay back with the profits of their album. And so that was supposed to happen piecemeal over 5 albums, and they never ended up releasing any albums.
No albums at all.
Through that deal. They just released an album independently.
So they broke their contract?
They didn't break it. They were able to terminate it.
I was afraid that at the end they would be turned off to music, that this experience would have soured them so much that they would have just given up playing music. Did that happen at all?
The closest thing that happened to that was as they were going through the contract issues that led to them parting ways with Sony. They couldn't release any music, and their performance options were limited because it was known that they had a contractual entanglement. So they spent a lot of last year really without much that they could do. And I think that's as close as it got to that, because now that they can release music and can play again, they're ready to go all over again.
How old are they now?
They are, Jared's a little younger, so Malcolm and Alec are 15 and Jared is 14.
And they're still playing and they're still going to school?
Yeah, they just played on the BET Awards last weekend.
Oh, and they're not signed?
They're not signed. They released an album called Chaos 2 weeks ago, and independently. I'm not sure of the tour schedule, but they're playing through the summer. Because they're still in school, so they play a lot more in the summer when they can.
Luke Meyer is the director of the new documentary. It's called Breaking a Monster, and it opens in Los Angeles this weekend. Luke, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up on this program, 1 in 4 student loan borrowers are behind in their payments. 8 million in default, debt collectors, the private loan industry, even the federal.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Obama has agreed to forgive more than $170 million of debt owed by former students of the for-profit Corinthian Colleges. The company filed for bankruptcy last year. Many students had sued. They said their degrees were worthless. The colleges weren't teaching the basics. Many weren't accredited. Most of Corinthian students were right here in California. Well, looking at the bigger picture, total student debt in America is $1.3 trillion. Yes, trillion with a T. With that much money on the line, we know who the losers are, the students who either can't afford to pay their loans back or remain saddled with high debt payments for decades. But who are the winners? Who's making money off this surge in student debt? Joining us to discuss this is Lance Williams. He was part of a team that investigated that very question for the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he's here now. Hi.
How you doing?
Great. Well, in the article, you profiled two characters who really represent the two sides of this story. There is a woman who's a recent graduate struggling with her loans, and then there's a guy named Albert Lord, one of the highest paid executives in Washington. Tell us how these two exemplify what you're talking about.
Yes, the young woman you're referencing is named Jessie Surin. Went to an orphan school and then did well in high school and went to a private college in Philadelphia. She's from Pennsylvania and borrowed a lot of money to pay for it. Her career plans didn't work out. And now, as she says, I'm a student debt slave. She's never missed a payment, but her loan balance has gone up $20,000 since she borrowed $71,000, so it's in the 90 range, and she works 2 or 3 jobs trying just to stay on top of her debt. She's emblematic of, I think, millions of people who made the same kind of mistakes that she made in terms of borrowing decisions and now has to live with it for her whole life. Our story contrasted her journey with that of Mr. Albert Lord, who was CEO of Sallie Mae. Sallie Mae, now called Navient, was a former government related corporation that was fully privatized in the 90s and became a hot stock on Wall Street. Mr. Lord made a lot of money as he created a sort of verticalized student loan business in which they underwrote loans, serviced them, and even collected on them. Made a lot of money doing that. And Mr. Lord's journey is easier than Jesse's at this point. We did write about the wealth he accumulated enough to, well, build himself his own private golf course near the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. It's just for him and his friends.
Sallie Mae, let's talk about that. This is the center of your story. How did it become what it became? How was it privatized in the 1990s?
Well, if you've been around a while, you remember the Speaker Newt Gingrich and the Contract for America, and there was a wave of interest in privatizing government services. There was a belief that the private industry could do it better and cheaper and more effectively than the bureaucracy. So it was in that context, and in the trade-offs when President Clinton was trying to assert a bigger role for the federal government in issuing student loans, that we wound up privatizing the industry. Sallie Mae became just a private company. Its stock went up on the stock exchange. Restrictions that had existed against it, buying related businesses, debt collection concerns, and so forth, all went by the boards, and away we went.
Well, now, you quote Albert Lord as saying, look, it's not us. We're not contributing to this. It's the problem with the government, and it's the problem with soaring college costs, that colleges are now charging so much more that students have to take out these enormous loans. And the government owns most of these loans.
Well, Mr. Lord has a point. We reported on the trend, everyone knows about it, the disinvestment in public higher education, state legislatures all over the country, gearing back on how much they put into paying for their state university systems. We calculated that if states had continued to support public higher ed at the rates they were doing in 1980, they would have put an additional $500 billion into them since then. And that's about the same amount of money that people who enrolled in public colleges and universities during that period borrowed. So there's a little symmetry there.
Direct relation. Right. So does he have a point that it's not really the privatization that's the problem when it comes to the loan industry, at least?
Pardon me. I was going to say everybody brings something to the party. And there's no doubt that we finance or expect students to finance their higher educations just by borrowing. That's kind of what we've been doing. And so is it wrong to blame the businesses that have made a fortune because of that dynamic?
Well, what about the federal government? What's its role here? Because it's making a bunch of money, too.
It is. The government loans student loans at a higher rate than it borrows the money to accumulate the loan money. So, yes, the government makes a lot of money. The General Accounting Office did a study that the five-year period between 2007 and 2012, loans written during that period are going to profit the federal government by $66 billion, as in B with a billion, over the life of those loans, that is, by the time they're all paid back. That's a lot of money, and that's straight into the general fund, as we say. It's a reason reform efforts aimed at people who already have loans, it's so difficult to construct a reform because it would be so expensive and the government would lose all that revenue it's become accustomed to having.
And this money goes into the general fund. It doesn't go to pay back these students or to lower their interest rates or anything
No, absolutely not. If we want to do that, we can do that, but we'll have to spend money to do it. And that's a tough sell. Especially with the current Congress, of course.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's Lance Williams. He is senior reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can read his article. It's got lots more information in it. It's called Who Got Rich Off the Student Debt Crisis? You can read it at revealnews.org. And Jolie Myers is here now with listener feedback. Hi there.
Hello. So Reveal, that then that article we just talked about, they have an interesting social media campaign. It's a hashtag called My Debt Could Buy, meaning what would you buy with the debt that you currently have if it was in the plus column instead of the minus column. Sarah E. Trodson says, hashtag My Debt Could Buy almost 3 years of my current rent, or a new luxury car, or 12 balcony rooms on a 7-day Alaskan cruise. A literal bunny tweets that hashtag My Debt Could Buy a 7-foot Captain America statue, an add-on room for my grandma, 10 plus copies of Lemonade on vinyl, and I'm one of the lucky ones. Lillian Cohen Moore says, hashtag My Debt Could Buy home medical equipment, ergonomic office chair, camera, new computer, more spinal procedures, hella cute orthopedic shoes. Very specific. And G. Jenny Zhu tweets that the award for the saddest hashtag I've seen today goes to hashtag My Debt Could Buy, where users say they could have what they could have in place of student loan debt. Despite its sadness, we want to hear from you as well. Hashtag My Debt Could Buy on Twitter.
Okay, great. And one of the saddest parts of that story is that they're actually going after people on Social Security and garnishing their Social Security benefits to pay back their student loan debt. Okay, thank you, Jolie Myers, and thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.